How did an unschooled, poor minivan driver from the deserts of Yemen become a driver for Osama bin Laden and ultimately the plaintiff in one of the most important Supreme Court cases in recent history? For the past several years, journalist Jonathan Mahler has been piecing together the story of Salem Hamdan. He's interviewed Hamdan's family, his U.S. interrogators, and the man who recruited him back in Yemen. And the result is a book just out called The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Mahler says Hamdan was recruited for jihad in Yemen at age 26, went to Afghanistan, and was drawn by Osama bin Laden's message.
It appealed to Hamdan in part because, you know, here was an uneducated Yemeni, was living an aimless life in Yemen, had, you know, only a part-time job, spent most of his time chewing cot and hanging out in a boarding house he slept in or in front of a mosque with really nothing to do. And the idea of having a kind of purpose, a mission, was, I think, appealing to him. And also, frankly, I think the fact that he was going to be earning a salary was appealing to him because he wasn't making much money in Yemen.
It's not every jihadi who becomes a driver for Osama bin Laden or a bodyguard, as by some accounts he was. What made him get that close to the leader of al-Qaeda?
Certainly, he was there for a number of years, beginning in 1996 and continuing through 2001. So longevity was certainly a factor. But I think also, not to get too psychoanalytical here, but Hamdan was orphaned at an early age. He kind of drifted around Yemen before going off to jihad. And he's the kind of person who's naturally drawn to strong personalities. I think that, you know, he liked kind of being under bin Laden's wing in a sense.
Hamdan is captured in Afghanistan in November of 2001 and is ultimately taken to Guantanamo Bay. And you spoke with the FBI interrogator, Ali Soufan. What did he tell you about the information that he was gleaning from Salem Hamdan and how valuable he was?
Soufan found Hamdan to be very helpful, actually, and I think they developed something of a relationship. Soufan and his partner used to bring him fillet of fish sandwiches from McDonald's down there and car and truck magazines, which Hamdan apparently loved. And Hamdan, in fact, was very cooperative. He identified photographs of bodyguards down on Guantanamo, and he also helped piece together bin Laden's kind of the travel log of bin Laden's kind of odyssey around Afghanistan, where bin Laden had been and where he might go. So he was, in fact, so cooperative that Soufan was thinking he would make a great material witness in the cases of some bigger al-Qaeda guys. But in fact, the government decided to try Hamdan himself.
You write a lot about Salem Hamdan's relationship with his defense attorneys, Neil Katyal, and also the Navy JAG, Charles Swift. And why don't you talk a bit about how they were able to gain his trust?
Well, Swift was appointed by the Pentagon to represent Hamdan as soon as he was designated for these military tribunals. And not surprisingly, here's a guy who's been in U.S. custody for a couple years now, has been interrogated dozens of times, and he's thinking, yeah, sure, you're my defense attorney. So it took Swift quite a long time to earn Hamdan's trust. And actually, it's funny, in one of their very first meetings, their second meeting, in fact, Swift had told Hamdan that, listen, I intend to vigorously defend you, and part of that defense is going to entail suing my commander-in-chief, President Bush, if you're game, over the legality of these military tribunals. And at the end of the meeting, as Swift was getting up to leave to fly back to Virginia, he said to Hamdan, so do you trust me? Do you believe I'm here to help you? And Hamdan said, a drowning man will cling to any hand that's extended to him.
Hamdan's name, of course, is on the Supreme Court ruling in this case that came out in 2006. And as you write, that ruling was not just about military commissions. It was about, in your words, nothing less than the president's obligation to comply with the law. And you describe his lawyers bringing a copy of that Supreme Court opinion, this major opinion, down to Guantanamo to show to Salem Hamdan. What happened?
Well, Hamdan initially, of course, was unable to understand. He's a man with a fourth-grade education who comes from a country where they observe Sharia law. So all of this law was really lost on Hamdan for quite a while. But over time, he began to kind of understand what was at stake in his case. And so he was feeling pretty good about things for a little while. But then, of course, what happened is that the Bush administration went to Congress to ask it to authorize these military tribunals, and he's on trial now.
If you look at the bill that was approved by Congress that authorizes these commissions now, it's pretty much identical to what the Supreme Court invalidated in the Hamdan case. So
yes.
What do you think ultimately is the legacy of that ruling and any impact that it'll have on the future?
Yeah, well, certainly that's true. I mean, the Supreme Court has, in fact, already ruled that the military Commissions Act was unconstitutional in the Boumediene case recently. And there will be more challenges after the verdict in Hamdan's case is rendered this week. Certainly his lawyers, if he is found guilty, and I think we all probably assume he will be, his lawyers are going to bring their challenge right back to federal court. So it's very hard to say where things are going to go, but certainly the fight over the legitimacy of these tribunals is certainly not over simply because they're taking place.
Jonathan Mahler is author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Jonathan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.